Blog Talk Radio.
Have you ever wondered why it's happening again?
Welcome to Mindshifters Radio with your co-host, the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice, and his wife Jeannie. Michael and Jeannie share with you the wisdom of the ancient Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. They offer tools and support 5 days a week. They will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Rachma. Michael is the author of Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information on Michael and Jeannie, please visit www.whyagain.com. And now your co-host, the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice.
To the brightness within you and the truth that is rooted within me.
Hi, and welcome to Mindshifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. Welcome you to the show. Today is Friday, June 13th, 2014, and our call-in number is 646-200-4169. Press 1, and that puts you in queue to talk to us, and we would love to hear your comments and your questions because that makes this your show. And this is Aramaic Friday, but I don't see Dale on there yet, and Dr. Tim's not with us yet, but let's welcome Michael.
Thank you, dear heart, and we are honored.
Michael, are you there?
I am, yes. Can you hear me?
Well, I'm not sure if Michael's there or not, but I see that Dale has joined us now.
I am.
So let's say hello.
You can't hear me? Hello?
Hi, I can hear Michael. You can't hear him? Hello?
I guess Jeannie can't hear me. That's interesting.
Maybe she can't hear me
but
either.
But you can hear me, Dale?
I can hear you.
I can hear you, Dale.
I can hear you. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can hear you loud and clear. That's strange. But anyway, not sure what's happening, but here we are, and we are honored and we are blessed that we have the opportunity once again to tap into these awesome ancient ideas that give us such an opportunity to move through to the true, total, complete experience of human life, no matter what's happening in our world. And, of course, to recognize that if we're not experiencing our human lives, then we've got work to do. And our definition of a human life is easy. Hold a newborn child. You know exactly what human life is. We got to play last week with that newest little human in your world, Dale. How is Shemaya?
Oh, yeah. She's beautiful. She's, wow. You know, I got that. I mean, I really learned that from you too. You know, by your actually living it, because you actually live what you talk about. There's so many people that I know who are great communicators, but they're not actually doing what they're talking about. They're not actually living it. And I learned a lot just even going back 20 years, first being around you, and how there'd be children in the room in your events, and people would go, oh. And you would say, well, understand that, you know, if you've got anything going on, that's an issue that's inside of you. That's something that's already within your being that's resonating right now in this process. So I do the very same thing myself in my gatherings, or like when I do my weekend retreats, Shemaya's there the whole time. And people are always thanking, not everybody, most of the people will come up and thank me for it. And it's funny because, you know, the ones who don't, they're usually just, you know, bless them. They're usually the same ones that are holding on at all kinds of other parts of the process as well. So holding on to whatever they're holding on to. But, yeah, she's just been a dancing light. We went to a little pizza place here in Asheville last night, and she was doing, like, twirls and pirouettes in the room, and it was she's a powerful little being.
Cool. Well, it's interesting you bring that up because we just finished doing a workshop at the office of a medical doctor here in Bristol, Tennessee. And if you're in this area and you need medical support, here's the place to go to. His name is Dr. Jim Shrinker. And let's see, his 11-month-old baby was in parts of the workshop. And, of course, babies make noises. And when I pointed out to everybody in the room that the disturbance they were feeling over baby noises are disturbances in themselves from their baby experience and being suppressed and shut up. It was interesting, and you know, there came a point where mom just couldn't handle it, and she had to take the baby out of the room. But that was mom's stuff, and you know, so we just went through that, and I kept saying, no, she's fine, please keep her here. And they have a son that's I think maybe 9, and he was kind of in and out of the room, and they're like, well, is that disturbing you? Well, no, actually, if disturbance comes up in me, I'll own it. I'll work through it, and I'll recognize it's not about this little one. And this physician actually mentioned the idea of, you know, children should be seen and suppressed, you know, seen and not heard, and how that dynamic plays out in the world. And so it's interesting you bring that up today of all days, because we just left there about 20 minutes ago. We had their whole staff, and he wanted us to train them in the process of forgiveness. So that's what we did with our morning this morning. And after we finish the show, I'm going to be packing up the van and be on the road to St. Louis.
Oh, wow.
So what do you bring to the plate for today, Dale? What's exciting and on your mind?
Well, I'm really – it's been like the subject of the last few weeks is that I'm so close to the finishing of the book, and I'm happy to say that my the first two sections of my book are completely finished in the first draft, the first two out of three. And those two are going out to California to a friend of mine named Hal Zinna Bennett, who's worked – he's been in publishing for 40 years. He's worked with Dr. Phil and Shakti Gawain and Gabrielle Roth and all these – amazing writers, and he's worked with a lot of people that he hasn't gotten any credit for, that he's just kind of there quietly in the background, and he's going to help tone up the text and help me see things that I'm not quite seeing. I'm getting an outside opinion from someone who's been in the industry for a really long time, who, you know, is of an open consciousness, so that by the time it does get into the hands of an agent and ultimately a publisher, that it's basically going to be the way I want it to be. And the last section of the book, there's only really a few scattered pages here and there for me to finish other than the introduction to the book, and that will be done. I'm going to be leaving early in the morning. I'll be in Melbourne, Florida for a few days at the Unity there, and then I'll be in the Unity in Fort Pierce the following weekend. But in the middle, I'm going to be going out to Lake Okeechobee in the middle of Florida, and I'm sort of holing up for 5 days to focus on finishing the rest of the book and just getting it done. And it's exciting. I'm, you know, a large chunk of the second book's already been written, and but I'm excited to just kind of let go of that whole aspect for at least a few weeks before I get into the finishing the second book. I'm going to probably, by the time the first book is published, my first three books will be done. And I'll already be on to that. I'm eager to get beyond. I love the toning. I love doing the toning. I think it's a great way to introduce people to the work. But I'm also eager to get beyond that in my work, to be able to get really deep into all of the how do we live a lot of these teachings and the translation aspects and everything. So I'm sort of on the hot iron of toning for a while, and then I'm going to be probably, I would say, you know, by the time that book comes out in spring of next year or so, the first book, I'll already be on beyond those books onto something else, which will be kind of nice, because I'm always expanding, always growing. It's kind of like Why Again. Every time I hear you doing Why Again, there's always something, just always fresh angles, fresh perspectives, and I sort of do that myself in my own life.
Awesome. Well, let's take a quick check-in with Jeannie. And Jeannie, can you hear us?
Yeah, I can. Did the introduction not come through?
Oh, yeah, the introduction came through, but both Dale and I were speaking and you couldn't hear us.
Yeah, we heard you. We heard you, okay. And we heard each other, but you didn't hear
good.
Us for some reason.
Okay, good. Dr. Tim is now with us as well. Nobody has their hand up yet, though.
Okay. Cool. Well, let's say hello and a welcome to Dr. Tim.
Good afternoon.
Well, good afternoon, sir. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thanks. I was with a crisis person last week during the show, so I listened to it after the fact and appreciated all the input. And Dale, I was listening to Inanna again today, and I had a thought. In there, you ask someone in the audience if they know the English translation of John 1:16 or something like that.
1:14 probably.
And then somebody says, I know, and they say, they give the answer as, for God so loved the world. And you said, no, that's John 3:16. That's good, though.
Yeah.
And my thought was, so what can you share with us of the ancient Aramaic translations that have been passed down as that God sent Jesus to atone for our sins?
Well, the thing about that is that's a lot of people today have no idea that that idea of the whole Jesus dying for our sins idea is hundreds of years removed from his actual lifespan. And it's an interesting subject because it's like if that subject comes up when people hear what I do or somehow if that subject comes up, they literally I know Michael experiences this too. They literally will often tell me, I don't want to hear what you know. I don't want to hear about your research. I don't want to hear about the history. Usually they don't actually come out and say it, but occasionally they do. It's sort of like a talk to the hand kind of effect. People don't even want to hear it. They don't want to hear any of like where a lot of these thoughts came from, these ideologies, these belief systems. They just don't want to hear it. But it's pretty amazing how when you actually start studying the actual history of the Bible, the life of Yeshua, etc., that there's a lot of really troubling, there's some unanswered questions, but there's also troubling things that happened that me and my research, I had to go in and I had to find that stuff inside of myself that was resonating with all of these different things that I was finding, things like the beautiful Saint Irenaeus or Constantine and the Council of Nicaea, or the Inquisition and all of these really beautiful phases of human history in relation to the Bible. But I mean, if you've got like a, do you have like a particular line or direction or questioning that you're asking, or, cause I mean, I know what you're getting at, but,
Well, I was specifically trying to look up, for God so loved the world that he sent his only begotten son.
That's John 3:16 there.
Yeah. And that's the one that so many people use as proof that we're only saved because Jesus died on the cross.
Yeah.
And so any insight into what might have actually been said in that Aramaic phrase.
Well, there's so much nuance in the phrase itself. First of all, it doesn't say anything about whatsoever in John 3:16 about somebody dying for someone's sins in any version anywhere. One of the interesting things about John 3:16, and one of the things that, you know, resonated a lot for me many years ago, is when I started actually getting deep into the research of that particular phrase, I started finding dozens of scholars talking about how that was actually a side margin note. Now, what I mean by that is when older, I think I've probably mentioned these on the show before, but when an older text is copied into a newer version, whether it's into another language or even just copied within its own language, one of the things that often happens is priests or just different clergy or people that have been using that text will often write notes in the margins. And sometimes those notes in the margins are very poetic in nature. They just feel inspired and they'll actually write them in the side margins. But one of the fairly standard practices was when you translated something from an old copy to a new copy, if there was something on those marginal notes that was very inspiring, they would just integrate it into the text, and it would be pulled in. Now, there's been dozens of researchers, like hard-nosed scholars, who do far more of the actual historical research than I'm even interested in doing. I'm interested more in the living or the application. I'm not so much interested in all of the, you know, the history of things, although I am interested in on some level. So many different researchers have been saying that that was actually a marginal note, that was something that was out on the side that was eventually integrated into the text. Exactly like in the Lord's Prayer, when you hear the line, "For thine is the power and the glory," "For thine is the power and the glory," in Aramaic was actually a marginal text. It was a marginal note that was pulled into the text later on in the Lord's Prayer, which is one of the reasons why what's in the Gospel of Luke as the Lord's Prayer is a little bit different than what's in the Gospel of Matthew. Luke doesn't contain that. It was added in Matthew. It wasn't added in later in Luke. But if you'd like, I mean, there's some things that we could actually go in and I can unpack a lot of the nuance that's in that phrase itself outside of all of the theology that's sort of wrapped around that whole only begotten son dying for our sins idea. If you'd like, we can get really, there's some really profound and opening insights, phrases and words in that one verse that's so incredibly open. And this was actually him talking to Nicodemus, the supposed leader of the Judeans, which I got to say this too. When you see the word Jew in the King James Bible, it doesn't actually mean, in most cases, Jew as we think of someone who's Jewish. What it actually means is the Judeans, and it was a really bad mistranslation going into Greek. So when you actually see the word Jews all over, they're not actually talking about Jews in most of those cases. They're just talking about the people of Judea, which was the little bit more of a southern region rather than Galilee, which was more the northern region. Galilee, of course, is where, you know, it was sort of Yeshua's stomping ground, so to speak. But Nicodemus, who he was speaking to here, Nicodemus came to him under the cover of night, you know, sort of like Albert LaChance would say, almost like crawling like a little spider or a dog with his tail between his legs because he didn't want to be seen. So coming to Jesus in the middle of the night and asking these questions like, how are you doing these healings? And, you know, what's the deal here? Something amazing is going on, and I want to know what's going on. And he wasn't really so much, it wasn't a criticism. It was like he wanted to know what the magic was almost. So if you guys would like, we could sort of unpack a few of the nuances in the verse.
Go for it.
Okay. Well, it's an interesting, there's a few things in here that I think that there's one word in particular, of course, that everything hangs on. And it's funny, like I see a lot of, I live in the buckle of the Bible Belt. Yes, I know it's a big buckle, but living here in North Carolina, there's a lot of bumper stickers that just say John 3:16. And of course, I see that and I'm like, okay, I know. And there's lots of billboards that have John 3:16 on it. There's lots of signs, and we even have graffiti here occasionally of John 3:16. It's an interesting little phenomena. But a lot of people don't actually go in and know. They don't know what the nuances are in that phrase. And the word that it really hangs on, I'm actually going to start with the hanger word or the clinch word, I would almost say, the root word, which is the word translated as only begotten. And only begotten is not a Christian idea in any way whatsoever. It's actually many, many thousands of years older than Christianity. The idea of God's only begotten Son, it's something that if you actually go and study, you'll find it especially in the Egyptian cultures. It's in Akkadian, it's in Phoenician, it's in Sumerian, it's in lots of different cultures. And a lot of people don't realize that the only begotten Son of God, S-O-N, actually comes from the philosophies about the only begotten Son, S-U-N, of God. As in, humans, going back 4,000 years, were just barely coming into the realization that what we view as our Son was actually the same thing as one of the stars that we see in the sky. So they were actually looking at our Son as being the brightest one in the sky, when our Son is probably not even 1 billionth or trillionth of the brightest stars that are somehow out there in the sky or the brightest sun. But at the time, all life was centered on Earth. Earth was the center point of everything. Earth was, everything revolved around the Earth. All the planets revolved around the Earth. The sun revolved around the Earth, as people believed. But there was new philosophies coming in at that time, going back about 3,000 and 4,000 years, where people were starting to say, hey, wait a second, maybe everything is rotating around the sun here, the S-U-N, sun. And that started making its way into the philosophy that sun was the only begotten Son, the only light of God. And, of course, it was the bringer of life, because if you put a plant in a shadow around the bend of something, around the corner where the sun can't see it, it's not going to grow, and it could actually die. It won't grow like it will if it's in the light of God, if it's in the sunlight of the only begotten Son. But that started making its way, especially into the Egyptian and the Coptic philosophies. And if you start going into Horus, who I've talked about in the past, you know, born on December 25th of the Virgin Isis Mary, you can go all the way down the line, dead for 3 days, arose on the third day, and all of that. That's an idea that was something that was around for a long time, that pretty much every commoner would have understood the ideology of the only begotten Son of God. So when you've got this Jesus guy who goes and does his thing, you know, Yeshua's got all of whatever happens in the first century, although we can't confirm anything, but at least what's written, and that story starts to take off, and the Roman Catholic Church starts going, hey, hold on a second here. We can actually create an economic, political, and religious base, something that we can pull all three of those ideologies or philosophies under one umbrella, and we can take this Coptic Egyptian idea of an only begotten and bring it into this. So a word was translated. The original Aramaic word is Yechidiah or Ichidiah. I'll get back to that sound. The word in Greek is monogones. Monogones is an interesting word because what monogones itself originally meant was the only one, okay? Now, what that means by the only one is not the only one as in Dr. Tim is the only one, but it doesn't include Michael Jeannie Dale or anybody else. What the only one means, even in the Greek, is in fact, it means one who has come into the direct actualization or realization that they are literally one with everything, that there really is truly only one game in town. There's only one being, and I am within and a part of and an expression of that being. Now, that word monogenes, though, it sat there in the text for several hundred years. It was there most likely in the late first century in the Greek. It was probably already there in John 3:16. Some people say it's closer more to the beginning of the second century, which I think I lean somewhere in the middle of that. A lot of the texts that are dated, you know, people give a lot of these texts and the dating. Those dates don't come from carbon dating. The dating of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John and all these different texts, that's not done by carbon dating because we don't have any of the originals, not one. That's actually done by educated guesses, and I think a lot of people don't realize that. It's just people guessing according to the information we have. But that word monogenes in Greek sat there in the text for several centuries until the 4th century in the year 325 AD at the Council of Nicaea, overseen by Constantine, Emperor Constantine. They chose to give it a definition, and the definition that they gave it in the 4th century, they had four possible definitions, and they were going to choose from one of the four. They literally picked one, and the one that they picked was to say that monogenes means only begotten. The reason they picked only begotten, and it's right there in the research, is that they felt that because of the predominance of the ideology or theology of the Coptic only begotten of Horus and all of these other sun gods that had existed, Dionysus, Osiris, you can go on, Mithras, there's so many of them, they knew that people would swallow the Jesus story just a little bit easier. So that's how all these pagan festivals got tagged in. So here we are, we've got monogenes. In the 4th century, they define it as only begotten, when actually there's a phrase that sounds more like monogenes pais in Greek, which actually means something closer to the only child born from a family, which would be more what only begotten would mean. But so we've got monogenes originally meaning the only one in the Greek. Monogenes actually was inspired by a word in Aramaic, that word Ichidiah. Now, Ichidiah had been in the Semitic languages for thousands of years at that point. It was in poetry. We can find texts from like the year 600 BC and look into those texts and find that word Ichidiah because it was there in Aramaic poeticism. It was a poetic word. And what it meant, when you see a lot of the translations, it says the only one. But let me actually break down that word only begotten in Aramaic. Now, first of all, in Greek, it's monogones. So mono means what? It means one. Gones, of course, if you just use your imagination a little, I think you can figure out what gones means. It would mean born or the only birthed. Now, if you look in Aramaic, there's Yahud Ayah. Now, going backwards, the last sound in the word is Ayah. Ayah is the sound that, in Aramaic, it's the letters Yod and Aleph. And what Ayah means, it means something that has no physical boundary. It has no beginning and no ending. Ayah is also at the end of the word Shemaya, which is not only my little girl's name, it's the word for heaven, which means because there's no physical boundary that heaven is either everywhere or heaven is nowhere. Now, only begotten in Aramaic, Yechidayah has that same root meaning, only, as in a person who has no physical boundaries. They are literally in consciousness, one with everything. There's no veils, there's no bushel baskets, there's nothing concealing their true light whatsoever. Right before the sound Ayah is the sound Chud, and Chud in Aramaic is literally the word one. So we do have an only there, because if it's only, it could possibly be the only one. And then the first sound in Yechidayah is the sound Yah. And Yah is the same sound that you would find in Yahweh and lots of different places. What Yah, the sound Yah, means in the ancient Semitic languages is who. But it doesn't mean who like Dr. Tim who, or Michael who, or Dale who, or Jeannie who. What it actually means, or Cindy Lou Who, of course, you got to remember her, but what that actually means is not who as in a person, it means highest awareness. It's like the I within the I, or the who within the who. So when you see the Yah sound at the beginning of Yechidayah, in one way it's saying, you know, not Jesus as a physical person, but rather his highest consciousness. But what it's also saying is because it's the beginning of the sound Yahweh, it's also saying that the highest consciousness of Jesus, who is now one with everything, now seeing that Yeshua has no boundaries and those blinders are all down, by being one with everything, he's in the realization that he is also the consciousness of Yahweh itself, himself, whatever you want to say. So our highest consciousness, our eye within the eye, is literally the eye of everything. It's the eye of God. It's the eye of the absolute only being. So you've got Yahud Ayah, that absolutely singular in being and limitless in all perception, who is literally the consciousness of God living in human form, which is exactly who all of us are when there's no veils, when the bushels are down. It's exactly what Michael says. It's the baby in the first 20 minutes of life. That's what only begotten means. And it's also, we are only begotten when we are open in any moment after a forgiveness process or still point breathing or whatever it may be. Even as musicians or creative beings, when you're one singular, you are the one. You are that open creative flow. I love what Ron Roth used to say. He used to say that he felt that we are most like God when we are creating. Whether it's speaking, a book, you know, you're making ice cream, whatever it may be. And that's that aspect. So what that actually meant, only begotten in Aramaic, is not somehow someone that holds something that we don't have, but rather they realize that there's nothing that one person can have that anyone else can't have. Because if you're only begotten, you've literally pulled down all the blinders. And what we've done is by translating that in the Egyptian definition, we made him the only begotten, and we literally took what he said in John 3:16 and flipped it 180 degrees, perfectly opposite of its original Aramaic meaning. And we literally killed the messenger. And this time, the one that we killed was Yeshua. We killed his message yet again with a really bad translation. If people would just go in and study just that word alone, I think they would be almost horrified at times. And that's the thing for me, is in the research, the horror is something that's already in me. And the reason I keep studying is to pull that stuff out of myself. It's to go into these continual forgiveness processes with all of the mangling of all of these teachings so that I can actually see what's there on the page clearly despite any kind of mistranslations or intentional manipulations, whatever. And that's just the nuance of one word in John 3:16.
Wow.
I know it's a lie, and I probably talked for 10 minutes nonstop without a breath, but...
Well, it's wonderful for me. It's helping create that space similar to when you were here. I'm just sitting here in the flow, and my concept of that word and what it means to be part of the one being is just sinking in a little bit deeper.
One of the things that that I see with when the Greeks take Yeshua's teachings and translate them into Greek is that there's nowhere that I'm aware of that they enhance anything that he said. But there are many places where they bring down what he said. And that whenever one looks back at the Aramaic original words, there's always a bigger flower. You know, in the passage, the question they're asking, there's some kind of a gift. There's some kind of a flower in it that they've gotten from the Greek. And when they go to the Aramaic, there's always a bigger, more powerful, more empowering and generous message in the Aramaic, in the actual original words. So people can drop their fear-based minds about, oh, this might be different than what I knew. There's always a bigger gift behind it than the one that was put out by the front by the Greeks, because they watered it down. They didn't have the brain cells. You know, he says you've got to have the eyes to see and the ears to hear what I'm teaching, and they didn't have it. So that always finding that bigger gift. I've never found a passage in the Aramaic that I went to the Greek and went, wow, did I ever get an understanding of that from the Greek? Wow, is that ever awesome?
That's such a valid point. That's a valid, very, 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 very valid point there that nobody seems to be talking about.
And the gifts, I mean, I wish we had the resources at this moment to go back and complete all of the translation work, because we don't have any idea how many gifts still lay in wait when we go back to that Aramaic, how much more is there when we go at depth into the psychology, at depth into the physiology, at depth into the genetics, have that level. You know, in this workshop we did this morning at this medical doctor's office, it was a woman, we're talking, of course, about forgiveness. We did the Why Is This Happening to Me Again workshop. And, you know, I brought up the idea that, you know, of the Greek translations, people are sitting around waiting for God to forgive them, as though forgiveness is about being let off the hook. And so, God, please forgive me, please forgive me, please let me off the hook. And I said, and God's never going to forgive you. And people are like, and she was like, oh, what? God's never going to forgive me. And then I went into the bigger flower, and it's like, so you've engaged in energies that never belonged in your structure, just like a thousand generations of your bloodline. You do not have even close to the kind of processing power it takes to remove that, but the Creator put in you a representative called Ruka Dukutcha that when you stop denying her, invite her into activity, will remove those energies that never belong, the word sin being an energy that's off the mark or an energy that never belongs. So when you invite that Ruka Dukutcha into activity, it will remove literally your sin, the energy that's off the mark, and you'd be freed of it. It won't be, you know, oftentimes people say, well, you know, I get forgiven so often. You know, I fall down and I'm forgiven, and I fall down and I'm forgiven, and then I fall down and I'm forgiven again, and then I fall down and I'm forgiven. It's never great that I'm, you know, have that belief system. And it's like, what if you took the bigger flower? What if you invited Ruka into the deepest parts of your dissociated mind, and you had that which causes you to fall down totally, completely removed? Not that God let you off the hook for having that weakness, but you had that weakness totally, completely removed. You did your part. You engaged in the forgiveness process and allowed that to be totally removed from you, and you don't fall down again. And it was just like, you could watch the light bulb go on in her mind. It was like, ah! It was a threat at first to hear the words, God's not going to forgive you, because forgiveness isn't about being let off the hook. But when you go to the deeper flower, that when you invite the Creator, the representative in us called Ruka Dukutcha, the super processor, so to speak, to lift that burden of your structure out of your emotions, out of your mind, out of your genetics, out of your physiology, and take away the diseases that go along with it, that's 10 times the power of just being let off the hook for the fact it's there and you're going to fall on your face again. It's like, get done with it. And, you know, we watch people all the time, and when they use these tools, I was talking, you know, when Rex was talking yesterday, afterward we spoke with someone who's, well, they're reading some people who believe that Yeshua never even existed. And then he said, well, and I use these tools and they work, but what if Yeshua never existed? It's like, so what's that got to do with it?
Yeah, it's got nothing to do with it, actually. Yeah.
He brought tools. You know, there are people who are going to live in denial forever, so let them be. But take what he taught and put it to work, and the flower, the gift that comes when you use what he gave is just monumental.
Hmm. Yeah, it's something that I hear in a lot of my gatherings where people will just literally say, oh, well, if he didn't exist, it doesn't mean anything. And I'm like, I don't want to be the one to clue you in on it. Or maybe I do want to actually be the one to clue you in on this. But most of the philosophies that have been handed down to us are archetypical myths, and that doesn't mean that they're just fake made-up stories. That means there's a much wider, overarching system or almost like a deep primal human story that's embedded within that, you know. And you hit on another point that is so huge that is something that I've observed in the last 21 years in this, is that it's not encouraged for some reason in amongst biblical scholars to come in from the perception of science, or come in from the perception of physics, or come in from the perception of psychology. There's this interesting fear, and it's a fear of going beyond the theology. Like, yeah, so we know that whatever, you know, this particular word means grace or blessing or whatever it may be. But there's this interesting fear with a lot of people where they don't want to go beyond that theological term. Well, you can tell me what it means blessing, but what does blessing mean? It's grace. What does grace mean? You know, it's glory. What does glory mean? And that's an interesting thing that that's why I'm so thankful of starting with, you know, what came through the Kabbalist Codex Foundation, because they boiled it down to its absolute essence. There was no theology. There was no theological gunk and goop left. It was just open, and it was right there in how you live it. And that's the amazing thing to me, is I must say, most of the people that I've ever seen that are, no matter how long they've been translating, most don't actually understand what it actually means that it is that they translated. They can give you thousands of definitions. They can give you all kinds of definitions. But still, strangely enough, they don't know what those words that they translated it as mean. And if there's anything that I'm here to do, it's to take it to its absolute, take it to the end, bring it all the way home. How do we live it? And if we don't know how to live it, then we're not. Then our job isn't done. We've stopped. We've sort of pulled the key out of the car before the car got to its destination. But it's not encouraged, and it's an interesting thing. It's not encouraged. It's not encouraged in a lot of scholarship to go against the grain. It's not encouraged in a lot of scholarship to actually look at it from lots of different angles that someone hasn't looked at it as. What's actually usually encouraged is backing up the systems of thought and beliefs that we already have in place. And, you know, maybe that's why I'm not welcome into the room as much. And I'm 100% fine with that. That's great, because I'm not here to bog down in theology and belief systems. I'm here to actually live it. And if I'm living it, then none of my translations really mean anything, you know?
And when you take it to the world, you know, the whole idea from the beginning with the Kabbalists was, rather than try to take it to the world of scholarship, because the world of scholarship already had it made up, that it understood it all, it knew it all. Oh, well, there are a few nuances we're looking for, but we got the basic story. And, you know, the difference between doing it in the ivory tower in one's head and intellectualizing and debating and bringing it down to what works. And the idea of the Kabbalists from the beginning has been to take this to people, to real people in real life situations. We had a woman in the workshop this morning that, you know, on the worksheet we have people assess what their level of upset is. And, of course, I always say make it on a scale of 0 to 10, make it something less than a 3. And so this woman picked an issue that was disturbing to her, but, you know, it wasn't a big deal. And as she got about two-thirds of the way through the worksheet, she shared with the group, she's like, this issue has run my whole life. This has just run everything. And then, as is always most amazing to me, when you actually follow the way, the truth, and the life, Yeshua, and how he said to engage the world, when she did the forgiveness process and was able to collapse that, afterwards she just sat there with this big grin on her face and this look of relief, and it's like, this is gone. This, when I started on a scale of 1 to 10, was 100, and it's a 0 now, and it's run my whole life. What a gift out of one simple worksheet. And, you know, the application of it, the actually taking it and applying it is so monumental.
Hmm. Yeah, and it's time. I mean, it really is time right now. I don't, you know, and I've said it before, I think if you and I were out there 50 years ago, people wouldn't have been quite so interested in listening. But they've seen that culture doesn't work without consciousness. It doesn't work without awareness of actually going in and figuring out why these things are falling apart. And, you know, we're becoming, you know, much more conscious to the fact that we are creators. And I always say it, that it's, people are always asking me if I could live at any point in time, when would I live? I say, I'm living here now. This is the time. People are ready. Not everybody,
when you,
but
you
enough.
Say, out there 50 years ago doing this, I was out there 45 years ago doing this, and people looked at me like I was some kind of a wacko.
Yeah.
And now people are going, wait a minute, how did that work? Tell me that again. And it's starting to move through the culture just in an amazing way. Jimmy tells us we've got a caller. Let's check in with the caller and see what they have to say. Caller, we're focused on the Aramaic Friday, so of course our questions are focused in the Aramaic language. So if you've got one for us, give us a name. Where are you calling from?
Just before I put the caller on, there was also a call from Carrie, or a question from Carrie on Tuesday, and I don't know if that got answered totally. She was asking about the gender of Rockman Kuba, like Ruka is feminine, and you had said to hold and maybe ask that of Dale.
Great. Thank you for remembering that, Jeannie. So there was the question, you know, we've talked and Carrie's been listening and so wondering about this gender of the feminine, and I did a brief explanation of what I'm starting to comprehend that you've uncovered, Dale, about the non-physical being the feminine and the manifest being masculine. Maybe you'd say a little bit about that before we get to our caller.
Well, Rachma, interestingly enough, Rachma is considered, it's a masculine gender. And what that means is that a lot of people don't realize Rachma is actually one of the primary words for friend in Aramaic. And what that means, what that word friend means on the deep level, you've got the Ra, which is the shining forth of heat and light. You have the Khum, or the Chum, which is the inner spiritual womb. And then you've got the Ma at the end, or the Ah sound at the end, which basically means birth, or something coming back into the one, birthing back into the one. And it was actually one of the primary words for friend, actually. It was translated usually as mercy or mercifulness, which is just horrible. Kuba. I'm trying to think of off the top of my head what the genderization of Kuba would be. If I'm not mistaken, I believe Kuba is feminine, but I'd have to look into it. Rachma is definitely a masculine gender term. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's a physical thing, but what it does mean is that most often in its genderization, that it was most often used as either the word for bowels, which I've talked about, which is how he came up with the bowel movement thing, or a friend. So interesting. It's something that they believed was an actual force, an actual physical force, as opposed to, say, something like Rucha, which is the breath spirit, which is a force that is creative yet non-created. And Rachma was something that they saw as something that actually is created, that's an actual force here on Earth, that is a palpable feeling that you feel and something that you can actually demonstrate. And, of course, that's where the bowels comes from. Like I say, in those moments of deep empathy or compassion, if you think about it, you know, you see someone you haven't seen in ages, your bowels actually move, whether you're aware of it or not. But it doesn't necessarily mean that it means bowel movement. But it's sort of that shows how it's something that happens on that literally that you can perceive on the level of the physical.
Something deep in the core shifts or moves.
Yeah, it's I almost look at it like, you know, Rahma to me is, it's one of those words that I'm not interested in overly defining because it's something that's so far beyond definition, but it literally threads itself from the non-manifest into the manifest. It's almost like a filament, like the word, like the milta, that is literally like a membrane of consciousness that's not an actual physical membrane, though it is, and though it's not necessarily non-manifest, though it is non-manifest and it is manifest, it's almost like Rahma is like the cosmic glue, but I don't want to say glue because then I think, you know, again, I'm thinking of some sort of physical goopy glue, but it's almost like it's the life inside of everything when we allow what's in everything to radiate and shine without all of the bushel baskets.
Awesome.
Very good.
Nice.
Okay, and we have two callers. So the first one's area code
9790.
Hey, everybody. It is Carrie. And thanks, Gina, for talking that out there. And really, that was kind of mainly the reason that I was calling in. I so appreciate the work that both of you guys have done in this field, or Dale, that you've continued to do, and everybody who's involved. But it's just one of the interesting things you just said about, first of all, let me just toss out, in addition to what Jeannie had said about that question, Michael always says Rukha Dakusha is a feminine principle. So I was wondering about that also. So maybe in a minute you could answer that. And the other thing, I'm not going to stay on here because you've pretty much answered what I was asking. And when you said in that when we're in creativity, we're kind of in the most state of being like God. And I really interestingly, I was led to these scrolls in Peru, which are called The Message of the Alpha and Omega, The Apocalyptic Message of Revelation 5 of the Lamb of God. And I have come to believe that they may very well have been transmitted by the same voice, beingness, spirit, whatever, that sent through, you know, the messages through Christ and the message, or Yeshua, and the messages through Moses. But one of the things that says in there over and over that's so interesting, and of course I'm reading them through Google Translator and they were transmitted in Spanish, so it's not a perfect translation, but it says, if you are in alignment with Source, your natural desire will be to work. And I'm thinking that that's what that means. Your natural desire will be true creativity, not to go out and work like a hamster in a cage, but to, because it is sort of that, when we're open to that flow of Source, there's a natural desire to create. So I thought that was really interesting that you said that. And just anyway, that's all I need to say. I'll let you guys go ahead because it's just great to listen. If I'm even still on.
Yeah, you're on.
Yeah, you're on. We got the
Okay.
So, Dan, do you want to say any more about work with the picture?
Well, yeah, I guess it was just the feminine. It really helped the other day, Michael, already what you said, but just that feminine and masculine qualities. And even that lady that called in at the end who knew Arabic, who was, that was really fascinating too. And I think that thing that Dale just said about Rahma, that the heat and light plus the womb and the birth into oneness or whatever it exactly was, but that really, I think that's what we're learning right now. It is the balancing of that masculine and feminine principle and giving birth to and letting go of our data that separates us from love and then being born into this divine oneness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's all. I'm going to hang up and listen to you guys.
I'm getting echo backs or something.
Is everybody hearing that?
I am.
Every time I say something, I hear it back. Every time someone else says something, I hear it twice. Interesting. Now it's not. Okay. You know, speaking of Rakhba and Kuba, if everyone, anybody who's got a Bible, if you open up the Bible to Matthew 5 and you go to verse 43 and 44, and I've got the Aramaic in front of me, so I don't have the King James, so I don't remember what the standard translation, but let me try to give it to you from Aramaic. You've heard that it's been said to love your neighbor, let's just keep it there, and to hate your enemy. But I am saying to you that, actually technically what it says is that the I within my I is saying to you, Lakun, that you must have Kuba. In the first case, he's saying you must have Rachma or Rahim, the Rahim for your neighbor, Lakarabak. And then he says that you have Achebu, which is Kuba, for Laboyeld Bubaykun. And Laboyeld Bubaykun is a word that in Aramaic means, the Laboyeld sound literally means to constrict or cut off the breath. Almost cancel the thought, you know, someone puts their hands around your throat and is trying to choke you or strangle you. That's basically what the Laboyeld sound means. And the Bubaik means something that's basically cut in half or something that's fighting against itself. And kun at the end of the word means all of you, you know, all of your enemies essentially. But yeah, he actually says right there, and if you have a King James, write down Matthew 5, write down verses 43 and 44. When he says love your neighbor, the word love is rachma. And when he says love your enemies, the word is achebu, which is kuba, for your enemies. So you can actually see where it shows up in the King James Bible if someone's interested. And looking at it, you know, it looks like the Chuba is also, in terms of the language, is gendered masculine. But here's one of the things I have. When I do a lot of my research with the Aramaic language, there's a lot of times that I see what the accepted gender of a word is, and I can look at it. And there's just times that I don't agree, and I know this makes me sound like some kind of a loony, and I'm fine with that, but there's times that I don't agree even with what all the other scholars are agreeing to in terms of genderization. And that's the thing. Gendering a word is a matter of opinion. It's not like we have, you know, a textbook from the first century and says, okay, this word was masculine, this word was feminine. We have no such thing. So I really do believe that there's certain words that are gendered, and the accepted gender within the linguistics community in a lot of the Jesus teachings, I don't believe that they're gendered properly. A lot of people will try to fall back that on certain sounds gives them their gender, but it's not a hard and fast rule. There's times when even when a certain sound is there, it's still gendered the opposite of what it normally means. So that's something that took me years to sort of really grow into in my work and my translation, to realize that if I just focus on how do we live what Jesus is saying, you know, how do we actually live the Yeshua teachings, which would be something, you know, from perceptions and attitude and experience and the direct state of being, which is feminine, and I just sort of err on the side of translating most things feminine unless he's basically talking about, look, you know, a physical thing, go do this physical thing, which was actually quite rare. The only time he ever talked about something physical was when it was relating it to the spiritual. So even now, all these years later, because I've read all the books that all of those scholars have read. I read the same, you know, trade papers. Maybe it's a good thing that I hadn't had certain things nailed into my head when I started this journey out, because for some reason in the beginning I was taking things out rather than putting them in. So maybe I'm not claiming to see something, you know, whatever, miraculous, but maybe I'm seeing something that they're not seeing. I don't know.
A couple of thoughts that I would have in recognizing that Rachma, you know, from the translation work that was done, And of course, there are many nuances, but one of the key one that we generally work with is that it's associated with intentions in the frontal lobes of the brain. And so thinking of it as a manifest expression, it would make sense, and I hadn't thought of it this way before, that it would be masculine. It's there, it's expressed. And I've come to see it as not only the filter in the frontal lobes of the brain that keeps us on track with love, allows only intentions keyed to love to come forward as the raw material of our goals. But it's also the gateway into which human life enters. And then when you tie in Rachma and neighbor, and the word neighbor in Aramaic being a mental word, anybody that you think about, and then have Kuba, that word is associated with the perceptual mind, where through perception one sees an enemy because they're not seeing that person through that filter keyed to love over perception. They're seeing it through their hostility or fear. And so their perception makes it up that this is the enemy. And Yeshua is saying that if you keep this condition active in your mind in the presence of what you call your enemy, the perception that puts them in the category of enemy is going to dissolve. If you're willing to let go of your hostility and your fear and your judgment and actually follow this first law of Rachma first, setting up the activity of Kuba as well. They're interrelated and interdependent filters.
Yeah, which are completely, I got to say, a completely, absolutely unknown in even the most expert analysis of the Aramaic language that I've ever seen. I've only ever seen that kind of depth in what came through the Kabbalist Codex Foundation. The general everyday scholar would just say poo-poo, frou-frou, there's nothing to it. And the weird thing about that is the thing that I say, because obviously it's bringing their stuff up, but they literally, it's like a la-la-la-la-la, put my fingers in my ears, talk to the hand, I don't even want to hear about it, especially not from some kid that doesn't have credentials before or after his name, which is funny because my friend Steve Caruso, who is the foremost, you know, not in terms of fame, but in terms of knowledge about the first century Galilean Aramaic dialect of Yeshua, he knows more about that than anyone else on this planet, and people still attack him because his name is not preceded and proceeded by tons of, you know, BS, DR, MS, MA, whatever it may be, because he doesn't have all kinds of credentials before and after his name. They literally tell him that they won't take him seriously, which is an interesting phenomena. And there's humility that just doesn't, I don't see a lot of humility there. And to me, if it's being lived, I'm interested. If it's something that they can't tell me how to live it, then I'm really not that interested. I'll read what they're saying, but, you know, in terms of, it's time. It's just time for the rubber to hit the road is what I'm saying. It's time to live it, and if we can't live it, then it's time for those people that aren't willing to live it to step to the back of the line so the ones that are willing to live it can be at the head of the line now, because that's why we're here. We're the ones we're waiting for, you know?
Right. When we took the Kabbalist text to an Aramaic-speaking group, native Aramaic speakers in Southern California, and we got discussing the word Rachma with them, they said that the meaning of it had been lost. They did not know what the meaning of Rachma was, but their tradition said that it was, what they did know about it was that it was the most precious jewel you could possess. And when you think about that and you recognize that it's something that keeps this body's mind on track with human life, with love, what more precious device could you have but that one? Because when that's not active within the mind, we don't have human life. The gateway's closed. It's gone. And all we have is carbon-based memory spewing out whatever garbage has been fed into it. So it's pretty amazing. And I don't believe it, but our hour's gone already. We're down to just the last few seconds. So we're going to have to close the show out. We'll just say thank you for being here. If you are in St. Louis, come and join us. DaleAllenHoffman.com is Dale's website. He's got a whole package of DVDs and CDs available that he's got a special price on. And you can see Dale's schedule on his website. And you can, of course, tap into ours. We'll be in St. Louis next week. We've got two workshops Tuesday and Wednesday night. Heartland opens up in July. And in the meantime, bring a stranger to the show tomorrow. Have the best year yet of your eternal life. It's the nicest gift you can give the world. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice, and his wife, Jeannie, who present the internal Aramaic process of forgiveness. Michael and Jeannie are here every Monday through Friday on Earth Angels Radio. For more on Michael and Jeannie, please visit www.1.com.
whyagain.com. That's www.whyagain.com.